pressured by U.S. sanctions if upholding the deals would lead to disproportionate economic loss. The judgment from the court in Luxembourg was prompted by a lawsuit from the German branch of Iran's state-owned bank Meli against Deutsche Telekom after the telecommunications provider terminated a contract with the bank in 2018 prior to its expiry.
The position of the European court, it's an indication that Iran cannot trust to sign any future deal with any European company, because although the European Court of Justice in Luxembourg accepted the lawsuit forwarded by the German branch of Iran Bank Meli against the Deutsche Telekom, however, the decision of the European bank is shameful.
The situation in the Israeli-occupied West Bank has become highly volatile. Israeli settlers have stepped up their attacks against Palestinian communities across the occupied territory. And Israeli forces have been using lethal force against the Palestinians more than often. Palestinian men, women, and even children have been losing their lives to Israeli gunfire. 2021 has been the deadliest year for Palestinian children since 2014. Increasingly frustrated with unending Israeli occupation, ongoing land grab, deadly violence, and lack of international action, some Palestinians have tried to take matters into their own hands by staging car ramming and stabbings against Israelis as some form of resistance against the regime. But the number of fatalities on the two sides is not comparable at all, as Israeli forces use disproportionate force against any form of protest or resistance against the regime. For years, human rights groups have accused Israel of following a shoot-to-kill policy. But things are apparently getting worse these days after the regime recently revised its open-fire policies. Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank are now allowed to open fire on Palestinians who throw rocks or Molotov cocktails, even when they don't pose an immediate threat.
I think what the regime is trying to achieve here can be expressed in two words. Dead Palestinians is what it's trying to achieve. One of the major objectives of Zionism is to clear Palestine of all Palestinians and have only Zionist Jews there.
The new open fire policy blatantly violates international law and has drawn widespread condemnation. Palestinians held a funeral on Thursday for a young man who was killed by Israeli gunfire. The mourning procession was held in the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammad Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Such deadly shootings of Palestinians seem to be on the rise in the West Bank. On Tuesday, a Palestinian motorist was gunned down in the northern occupied West Bank after what the Israeli military said was an attempted car ramming of soldiers at a checkpoint. Israel seems determined to keep up its use of deadly force against the Palestinians, even when there is no immediate threat. Earlier in December, the United Nations Human Rights Office said it was, quote, shocked by the apparent extrajudicial execution of a Palestinian man who had injured an Israeli with a knife, but was shot and lying on the ground. Israeli forces continued to shoot the man from point blank, even when he was posing no threat. Such shootings are undoubtedly extrajudicial field executions that violate international law. Will Israel's illegal and hard-handed tactics force the Palestinians into submission? Probably not, as Palestinian resistance groups are calling for intensified acts of retaliation against Israel across Palestinian territories. The leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad recently stressed the need for continued resistance operations in the West Bank, saying that the Zionist regime's aggression in the region would have serious consequences and that Tel Aviv would pay a heavy price for its aggressions.
The more oppression they bring upon Palestinians, the more resistance they're going to get. And in fact, this has been true historically for any people that are under oppression. When you're under oppression, you're going to resist, and there will be people who are willing to pay any price to resist.
The occupied West Bank could experience more tensions and deadly violence against the Palestinians in the coming weeks, as the Israeli regime refuses to change its dangerous course.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In portraying the Zionist settler colony as a democracy with alleged human rights and coexistence between various religions, the Israeli regime has attempted to whitewash its genocidal oppression of Palestinians in the eyes of the West. We now present you an article written by Danijal Yejik, a writer and researcher currently based in Beirut, Lebanon. He has a PhD in American Studies. The article is titled, "The Apartheid Regime's Christmas Propaganda and Oppression of Palestinian Christians." People around the world are celebrating Christmas. Occupied Palestine, the birthplace of Christianity, remains under brutal Israeli apartheid occupation. Meanwhile, the Israeli regime targets Western Christians and with Zionist propaganda. The Israeli propaganda apparatus, Hasbara, has long invested large amounts of money and significant public relations efforts in legitimizing the Zionist settler colony in the eyes of the international audience. In portraying the colony as a democracy with alleged human rights and coexistence between various religions, the Israeli regime has attempted to whitewash its genocidal oppression of the Palestinians in the eyes of the West. As a result of propaganda attempts by the child-killing Zionist regime, many Christians in the West either ignore the plight of the Palestinians or provide outright support for the Israeli apartheid regime. Evangelical Zionists in the United States have been amongst the most radical supporters of the Israeli regime. Christian tourism has contributed to the colony's economy. This year again, Zionist politicians and officials have extended their holiday greetings to Christian friends around the world. Such greetings are packed with colonial propaganda and appropriation of history. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Naftali Bennett published a video on Christmas Eve this year from the occupied city of Al-Quds, connecting the ancient land and the Bible to the current colony in his address to Christians. Naftali Bennett, who previously bragged about how many Arabs he killed in his life, lied that the colony provided religious freedom, tolerance, and prosperity in a region where Christians are routinely persecuted. The illusion that Israel offered religious freedom and that Christians outside of the colony are persecuted is widespread in the West. Naftali Bennett claimed that Israel is the only place that protects Christian life and thanked his audience for fighting for the state of Israel. While such proclamations further add to the purported positive image of the colony in the West, they stand in stark contrast to the reality on the ground. In fact, the world's oldest Christian communities are victims of Israel's genocidal settler colonialism. As a result of Israel's ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign, the Christian population in Palestine has sharply declined throughout recent decades. Places of significant importance for Christians are cut off from the outside world. The town of Beit Lahem in the occupied West Bank, the birthplace of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, is surrounded by an apartheid wall. Besides suffering under structures of the apartheid regime, Palestinian Christians are also oftentimes prevented from exercising their religion. While foreign visitors may access Palestinian churches, the Palestinian right to worship is tightly controlled by the Israeli apartheid regime. Depending on where they live, Palestinians require permits issued by the apartheid authorities to attend Mass in churches. This year again, Palestinian Christians from Gaza applied for permits to travel to Beit Lahem to attend prayers. Their requests were either rejected or outright ignored. Palestinians are harassed by apartheid authorities on holy days such as Easter and Christmas. This year, on Easter, apartheid authorities escalated their ethnic cleansing campaign by expelling Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah in eastern occupied Al-Quds from their homes. This Christmas again, hundreds of Palestinians were injured by Israeli occupation forces when they protested against settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Israeli violence has always extended beyond the borders of historic Palestine. The Israeli colonial regime has a history of targeting indigenous Christians in the region. It has done so during its military occupation and numerous wars in Lebanon, and its continuous attacks in Syria. During last year's Christmas celebrations, the Israeli regime invaded the Lebanese airspace to conduct airstrikes on Syria, killing several innocent Syrians. The Israeli regime is terrorizing Palestinians of all religions, but has been trying to portray the settler colonial conquest as a conflict that is allegedly religious in its nature. Exploiting traditional Orientalism and anti-Muslim sentiments that are prevalent in Western culture, the Israeli rhetoric has long focused not only on portraying Palestinian resistance, and oftentimes the very Palestinian existence as such, as anti-Jewish, but the regime has also tried to identify all Palestinians as Muslims, to better advance its Islamophobic dichotomy and to frame the Palestinian struggle for freedom and liberation as a religious movement. It is the religious frame and the anti-Muslim prejudice among Israel's backers that allows the apartheid regime to advance its goals. It is thus not surprising that the Israeli project is popular among the far right and fascists around the world. Of course, the Palestinian struggle was never a sectarian one, and many leading figures of Palestinian resistance have been Christians. Nor should the religion of colonized people determine the solidarity and support they receive from the outside world. After all, destroying the cultural diversity of the region and dividing the population according to sectarian and ethnic lines have been long-established practices of imperialists and colonialist forces. Numerous Palestinian Christian leaders have appealed to Christians around the world to not turn a blind eye towards the continuous oppression and exploitation of Palestine. The Palestinian Archbishop of Greek Orthodox Church in Al-Quds, Atala Hana, himself a crucial figure in the Palestinian resistance, has repeatedly affirmed that the holy city of Al-Quds and the holy sites will remain Palestinian. The Palestinian Archbishop reminded Christians around the world that while streets and squares in Western cities are decorated with lights and Christmas trees, there would be no point in celebrating Christmas if they do not pay attention to what is happening in Palestine. He called upon all churches to urgently defend Palestine. The Palestinian Archbishop has reportedly been poisoned by Israeli authorities but survived the attack. The racist ideology of Zionism targets people of all religious backgrounds who stand in the way of the settler colonial conquest. This is unfortunately more often than not ignored internationally, and particularly by Western Christians. This year, once again, many Christians in the West celebrate the birth of Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, without talking about the struggle in Palestine.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. You're listening to Youth Station broadcasting from IRIB English Radio Station. With you today is Brother Habib at your service and Sayyid
Jafar. Assalamu alaikum, how are you?
Alaikum assalam warahmatullah. Thank you for coming, brother. So of course, Sayyid, if you could please introduce yourself, where you're from.
Okay, I am originally Pakistani, but I was brought up in the U.S., in Houston.
So you're from Texas?
Yes.
Oh, from the southern part of the United States of America. No, we're from the sunny part of California. Anyway, so, Sayyid Jafar, we're going to be talking about your intentions in life. Not my intentions in life.
My intentions.
Your intentions in life.
Okay.
All right, so, I need a background.
Okay.
You give it to me, like, slowly how you came to Qom to study in Hausa.
Okay, so how did I come to Qom? It's a good story, honestly, I guess, in my opinion. Again, it's my story. But so I was...
It's about you.
Exactly.
We have to give you an award. Self-pride.
So I was brought up in a Pakistani household, but my parents are from Karachi, so the south of Pakistan.
Oh, Shia's over there, yeah.
Yeah, so near the ocean, right?
Yeah.
At the edge of Pakistan.
Beach boy, yeah.
Ironically, before I was born, my parents moved to America. And where did they pick? They picked a city that had the same weather as Karachi. It had the same, to an extent, the same location as Karachi. And they had a lot of people who, I guess, they were accustomed to that culture. Mm-hmm. You had a lot of Pakistanis move there.
So the community was a Pakistani community.
It was a Pakistani community. And ironically, Houston is in the south of America. It's near the coastline. Its weather is pretty much close to Karachi, where it's hot and humid. And it's not fairly that cold over there. Again, if it goes anywhere near 32 degrees Fahrenheit, or for my Celsius listeners here, 0 degrees Celsius, you would consider it really cold over there. We're not accustomed to the cold. But I was brought up there. I was born there. I was brought up there. Again, my parents had put me into an Islamic school at the beginning. Now, again, the basis of that was to at least keep my base of Islam intact, right?
Good parents.
Not to get shattered by the Western thoughts, culture,
lifestyle,
all of it, right? So it doesn't shatter that image of Islam that's
just between your words.
Obviously, their goal in the beginning was to safeguard that base, right? Make it strong enough where you can actually go out and the culture won't affect you as much as someone who doesn't have a base, right? But after a while, that school was only for elementary years. So I was only there to sixth grade. But then after that,
In high school, you were in public school, right?
Exactly. After that, so seventh and onwards, I was in public school, right? That's where I really saw what the quote-unquote American culture and lifestyle was.
America, yeah.
Right? So from that standpoint, obviously it was a shock for me because I was accustomed to a certain way of, say, not even just living, but even studying, getting to know people, interacting with people, right? From an Islamic background, immediately into a Western background. But because of that base, right, I didn't falter as much as someone who went straight into that American culture, right? Regarding the aspect of me coming to Qom and why I went to come to Qom, honestly, over there was a gap between the speakers, the scholars that used to come from Qom, and the youth over there. You had scholars who had studied for 30, 40 years, but they kept no connection with the West. So they had less connection with the youth compared to someone who was there in America growing up with them or understanding the issues that they were facing. And honestly, like I saw most of the, again, I was part of the youth, so I saw that most of our issues weren't being tackled. So I had made the decision to come and study myself and also, in a sense, keep a contact over there to understand what was going on and tailor those things that I was learning and seeing how I could help the youth that were there at that time and the youth that are going to come in the future and help them tackle those needs, those basic needs that they have in the West.
So that's your intention in life. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we have to take a short break. We will be back to continue this discussion. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome back to IRB English Radio Station. You guys are listening to Youth Station. We are talking, me and Sayyid Jaafar, we're talking about the concept of your intentions in life. How did you gain that love, that passion? So it was like, I know it has the parental background. They might have planted the seed that has grown into you, mashallah. But at the end of the day, still, there has to be a personal drive for your intention.
I feel like my personal drive was also just to honestly gain knowledge on my own here, to understand, like, really get the knowledge at its roots, right? Not to just hear it from someone else, because at least back in the day in the US, the main issue was you went to one mosque and they were saying something, you went to another mosque and they were saying something completely different, right? Just even if you don't fall into the whole Western culture trap, you're going to get lost between the different ideologies within the mosques.
Very nice.
Right? There's a lot of back and forth between the mosques themselves. I guess, in a sense, yeah, they are diverse. But if someone wasn't in line with the practices at one mosque, they would go and make their own mosque. They would run with their own practices. Now, a youth growing up in the West...
Of course, for all the Christians out there, you guys do the same thing with your community churches.
So, a youth growing up in that environment, seeing all the differences here, not seeing a connection, at least the way it should be.
So you're intrigued. You're curious about knowledge.
Exactly. I was curious to see...
What's the reality? What's the truth?
Why is everyone, you know, just splitting apart and doing their own thing? Why aren't we all coming together and doing something?
Of course, brother was saying that he wanted to know the reality, wanted to know the fact. And I see that a lot in houses. But most of the students, especially those who come from the West... Usually the reason that they have come to study, they have left their families, they have left their hometowns, they are homesick. Of course, they're not homesick with Sayyidah Masuma alayhi salam. Yeah, with the shrine of Lady Masuma alayhi salam, there's no such thing as homesick. But what I mean is that they left their homes, they have come to live in a different country, a new culture, and to study, to just go 4 hours of classes and go back to their homes and study more. The main reason why they do that is to know reality. They want to know what is the truth so they can follow the truth. And I really ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to bless you and to aid you more on your path. And now, of course, every human being in their intentions in life, your intention is to go back, what I understand, is to go back and to, you know, try to fill up that gap.
Yes.
How are you doing with your plan right now? Because, you know, we all have plans. I have a plan to be king of the world, but it's not going very good. Anyway.
Obviously, I can't say that, you know, everything has gone through the way that I had thought it out when I first got here. But again, keeping that goal in mind is really what's pushing me through all the hurdles that are coming up over here, right? Be it the sanctions, be it the school system here to an extent. What I mean is, obviously, the way they teach you in the West and the way the teachings are done in the East are different.
The methodology of teaching.
Yeah, the methods are different. Obviously, understanding and growing up with a Western method, it's harder to grasp the Eastern method of teaching.
The teacher's on the board giving you prizes and, you know, showing you stuff and images and stuff like that. Here you come down, you open the book, you look at the teacher while he's talking, you have to understand every single word that comes out of his mind. And that really makes smart people. It really does. Even though it might be a hard way, but if you put your time on it, it makes you a smarter person.
It does. The struggle that you go through here, at the end of the day, it does yield a stronger...
When do you plan on going back and continue? Because, you know, I believe that every human being should, you know, make their goal into parts, right? Step by step. There's the big step that you have to take that you say that I have completed this stage, right? I have to go on to another stage. When is that stage that you want to go back into, you know, the U.S. and continue your missionary goals?
In a sense, I had originally come with the idea of, you know, at least studying, say, 10 to 15 years. Right? Really have a sound base.
You want to be soaked in the knowledge.
Exactly. Where, in a sense, where any question, any concern that comes my way, like, I have an answer for it, right? I don't want to leave them, you know, empty-handed. But then now, also seeing how rapidly things are changing in the West and how it's becoming even more difficult for Muslims over there, I might have to cut back on that. I might, instead of doing 10 years, it might be 6 or 7 years.
Just to add on to something, 6 and 7 years is not enough.
That's true.
The goal that you put, 10 to 15 years, I was going to say is acceptable. I wanted to say that at least, like, you have to study more. And there's no such thing as stopping from studying. You're always seeking knowledge throughout your entire life. But I think that in Hausa, in your level, my level, I think the main base for us is to understand the methodology of, for example, they ask me a question. I'm not Google, for God's sakes. I'm Habib. I forget. I eat cheese. I forget. So when you ask me a question, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm going to tell you I don't know. But give me for like a couple of seconds, I'll go back. There's this nice story that I want to share with you, brother. It's a nice story for you. It's a nice story for the listeners out there who, you know, how to deal with missionaries. We're not infallibles. We do mistakes. We forget sometimes. There's this great Ayatollah, Sayyid Hussein al-Shahroudi. He gives out Kharij, Dars-e Kharij, which is pretty much the top level of studies here. Right, it's like a professor in your language. Anyway, he was asked a question, a simple question, a fiqh question that maybe me and you, even 6 years back, if I was asked the question, I would be able to answer it. He told him that, what's the difference between me and you? You told me you don't know the answer, that you have to go back home and check the book or check the issue. He told him that the difference between me and you is that when I go home, when I go to my 1,000 books that I have at my house, it is true, because I also have 1,000 books in my house. He has more. I'm pretty sure he has more. It's much bigger than mine, because I don't have a lot of encyclopedias. Anyway, when I go back home, I know where to go to the book. I know what page it is available in, and I remember it. As for you, when you go to that same library, you stand over there at the library, you don't know what book to open.
Well, at first, you're just intimidated by looking at the library.
Then you want to open it. Okay, you opened it. Where do you find it? Okay, let's say you found it. Can you understand it or not?
That's true.
So there's also a similar story. The structure of knowledge, knowing the structure of knowledge, knowing where this issue is available at, knowing the books where this issue was stated or mentioned, really helps us out. Another story that's similar, Sayyid Sa'id al-Hakim, the Marja, the great Ayatollah that passed away recently in Najaf. When people would come and visit him, they would ask him a question. He told them, give me Minhaj al-Salihin, the book where he has the issue, the fiqh issue, the verdict. He told him, give me. It's his book. He read it with his own hands. He forgot it. It's not a problem. We're not infallible, you know. So I think that the main thing is not to be able to answer right away. It's to deal with the community in a proper way and to know the knowledge structures. For example, they asked me a question about aqa'id. Where do I go? Theology, ideology, creeds, beliefs.
Okay, so my point of saying that, look, of me having the answer right then, and it wasn't just right then and there, but being able to have access to that answer, right? Because most scholars who haven't read as much, who haven't studied as deeply as they should have,
they don't know the structure.
And they come back, they're lost.
Yeah, exactly.
It goes back to that same story that you said. They know what it might be. They can beat around the bush all they want, but the core answer, they don't know where to look. Exactly. They don't know where to cite it.
Very nice.
Right? At the end of the day, I'm saying to just all those students as well, whatever field you're learning, right? In a sense, start teaching the basic concepts as well to further understand that through teaching, you really understand how much you don't know.
Exactly.
Right? Nice. You don't just read a book and be like, oh, look, I understood it. When you explain that book to someone else, that's where you really find out how much you don't know.
Now, I want to ask you a question. You know, alhamdulillah, you have an intention in life. I have an intention I'm not going to tell you on the radio. You want to know the intention? Invite me to your place. We'll have dinner. I'll tell you my intention if you're intrigued. Anyway, say it. Now, some people think that there is no necessity to have an intention in life. You don't have to have a goal in life, you know? It's enough that you're alive. Let's be alive. Let's taste. Let's test. Let's experience. Let's just be happy. Do you think that's proper? That's rational? Because I personally believe that that's not rational at all. Because when you say that I want to be happy, that's your intention in life. That makes it a goal. It's impossible to not have an intention. Anyway, what's your view on
it? Honestly, I agree with you in that aspect. If you don't have an end goal, whether it doesn't have to be a grand goal, it just has to be a goal personalized towards you, right? You're going to be stagnant in your life. You're not going to be moving forward, right? At the end of the day, life is there for you to move forward and understand more things, right? Meet more people, indulge in other cultures and other societies, right? It isn't just, look, I'm just going to do my thing. You know, what's your goal? I don't have a goal. You know, I'm just, you know,
wanna be
just
okay.
Testing the waters out, right? How long are you going to test them out for? You're going to lose that, the aspect of living, right? You're going to, in a way, you're going to be killing yourself without being dead.
Thank you very much, Sayyid, for your beautiful words and your story. And thank you guys for joining us. Until another Youth Station, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
When lawyers were preparing to defend against a lawsuit over a death in police custody in Fresno, California, they knew whom to call. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jennifer Valentino DeVries, Mike McIntyre, Rebecca Ruiz, and Julie Tate. The piece is titled How Paid Experts Help Exonerate Police After Deaths in Custody. When lawyers were preparing to defend against a lawsuit over a death in police custody in Fresno, California, they knew whom to call. Over the past two decades, Dr. Gary Wilker has established himself as a leading expert witness by repeatedly asserting that police officers and police techniques such as face-down restraints, stun gun shocks, and some neck holds did not kill people. Police officers in Fresno had handcuffed 41-year-old Joseph Perez and holding him face down on the ground put a spinal board from an ambulance on his back as he cried out for help. One police officer sat on the board as they strapped him onto it. The county medical examiner ruled his death in May of 2017 a homicide by asphyxiation. Dr. Gary Wilker, who was hired by the ambulance provider, charged $500 an hour and provided a different determination. He wrote in a report filed with the court this past July that Mr. Perez had died from methamphetamine use, heart disease, and the exertion of his struggle against the restraints. Dr. Gary Wilker, an emergency medicine doctor in San Diego, California, is an integral part of a small but influential cadre of scientists, lawyers, physicians, and other police experts whose research and testimony is almost always used to absolve police officers of blame for deaths. According to a review of hundreds of research papers and more than 25,000 pages of court documents, as well as interviews with nearly 36 people with knowledge of the deaths or the research. Their views infuriate many prosecutors, plaintiff lawyers, medical experts, and relatives of the dead, who accuse them of slanting science, ignoring inconvenient facts, and dangerously emboldening police officers to act aggressively. One of the researchers has suggested that police officers involved in the deaths are often unfairly blamed, like parents of babies who die of sudden infant death syndrome. The experts also intersect with law enforcement-friendly companies that train police officers, write police policies, and lend authority to studies rebutting concerns about police use of force. Together, they form what often amounts to a cottage industry of exoneration. The dozen or so individuals and companies have collected millions of dollars over the past decade, much of it in fees that are largely underwritten by taxpayers, who cover the costs of police training and police policies and the legal bills of accused police officers. Many of the experts also have ties to Axon, maker of the Taser. A lawyer for the company, for example, was an early sponsor of the Institute for Prevention of In-Custody Deaths, a commercial undertaking that is among the police-friendly entities. And some of the experts have worked as consultants for Axon, the Taser maker. Another has served on Axon's corporate board. The New York Times identified more than 100 instances of in-custody deaths or life-threatening injuries from the past 15 years, in which experts in the network were hired to defend police officers. The cases were nearly all civil lawsuits, as the police officers involved were rarely charged with crimes. About two-thirds of the cases were settled out of court. Of the 28 decided by judges or juries, 16 had outcomes favoring the police. A handful of cases are currently pending. Beyond the courtroom, the individuals and businesses have offered instruction to thousands of police officers and medical examiners, whose cause of death rulings often help determine legal culpability. Lexipol, a Texas-based business whose webinars and publications have included experts from the network, boasted it helped write policy manuals for 6,300 police departments, sometimes suggesting standards for police officers' conduct that reduce legal liability. A company spokeswoman said it did not rely on the researchers in making its policies. The self-reinforcing ecosystem underscores the difficulty of obtaining an impartial accounting of deaths in police custody, particularly in cases involving a struggle, where the cause of death is not immediately clear. The New York Times reported earlier this year that outside criminal investigations of such cases can be plagued with shortcuts and biases that favor the police, and that medical examiners sometimes tie the deaths to a biological trait that would rarely be deemed fatal in other circumstances. Some researchers and doctors in this ecosystem who responded to questions from the New York Times said they did not assist law enforcement but provided unbiased results of scientific research and opinions based on the facts of each case. Several pointed to research demonstrating that police struggles overall have an exceedingly low risk of death. They also highlighted health issues that could cause deaths in such circumstances, including the use of drugs, obesity, psychological disturbances, and genetic mutations that may predispose people to heart problems. Some also criticized research and medical opinions that found that police techniques might cause or contribute to deaths, suggesting these were flawed. They also pointed out that other academic papers have been written by people who testify against law enforcement in such cases. sensationalism, without offering scientifically demonstrated better control techniques, adds no benefit and merely exacerbates the existing tensions between law enforcement and the society at large, said Mark Kroll, a biomedical engineer who has backed the idea of an arrest-related death syndrome as an explanation of the deaths. Others in the network, including Dr. Gary Wilke, said it was wrong to characterize their work as favoring the police and suggested the New York Times' analysis misrepresented it. I would disagree, Dr. Gary Wilke said when the New York Times shared his findings with him. Another of the experts, Dr. Stephen Karch, sent papers suggesting black males and people exerting themselves were generally more likely to have sudden cardiac arrest. Lawyers for Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who was ultimately convicted in last year's murder of George Floyd, also drew upon the same network of researchers and experts. In particular, they turned to the defense of prone restraint, a technique in which officers subdue subjects face down, as happened to George Floyd. The work of Dr. Kroll, who has a PhD in electrical engineering but no medical degree, was cited by the Chauvin defense as proof that putting body weight on someone face down does not cause asphyxiation. The experts have been called on to defend a broad range of other police techniques, including taser shocks and neck holds. Medical examiners and investigators have also relied on the research. Omaha police officers used a taser 12 times when detaining Zachary Bare Heels in 2017 and punched him repeatedly in the head and neck. Dr. Kroll, who sits on Axon's corporate board, the maker of the taser, testified in the criminal trial that the stun gun could not have contributed to the death of Mr. Bare Heels, a 28-year-old with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. He also wrote a report in the civil case that is under seal. Police officers in Phoenix, Arizona held Miguel Ruiz in a neck hold and shocked him multiple times with a stun gun in 2013. In a civil case, Dr. Gary Wilke attested to the safety of neck holds that cut off blood flow to the head by compressing arteries, and another researcher, Dr. Charles Wetley, discussed excited delirium, a condition that some doctors say can suddenly kill drug users or the mentally ill. Sheriff deputies in Kern County, California handcuffed David Silver in 2013, bloodied him with batons, tried his hands, tied his hands and feet together behind his back, and pushed him face down into the ground. Two doctors in the expert network, Dr. Karch and Dr. Theodore Chan, agreed with the coroner's finding that David Silver did not asphyxiate. Dr. Chan cited studies he had done on the subject. Dr. Chan, who works in San Diego, California with Dr. Gary Wilke, is also serving as an expert witness in the lawsuit over the death of Mr. Perez in Fresno, California. Citing his own research, he stated that there was no evidence that such weight on a person's back could contribute to asphyxiation. Dr. Wetley, a former Miami medical examiner who died last year, was among the first to publish research that launched what has become an industry of sorts defending police officers. He wrote in the 1980s about men who had taken cocaine and died, many while being subdued by police. He attributed the deaths to a condition he called excited delirium, when someone becomes aggressive from a mental illness or psychoactive drugs. Later in 1994, two former law enforcement officers, Michael Brave and John Peters, described in a paper what they called custody death syndrome. The condition, they wrote, had no apparent detectable anatomical cause, but could be associated with excited delirium or other vague diagnoses. In describing the death of a hypothetical suspect, they focused on potential liability. You immediately cringe at the thought of the critical scrutiny you will soon be facing by the media, by council officials and by special interest groups, they wrote. The business of supporting law enforcement can be lucrative. Not all of the researchers testify frequently in courts of law, but when they do, experts associated with a network typically earn $500 to $1,000 an hour for testimony and depositions. Lexipol charges thousands of dollars in review and write policies for police departments. The Institute for Prevention of In-Custody Deaths also charges for its training programs and promotes its business partners. At the Institute's annual conference in Las Vegas last month, the price of admission was $695. The New York Times found that with rare exceptions when members of this network weigh in on a court case, they side with the police officers. Making determinations on death in custody cases is a complex and inexact process. The people being detained in the instances reviewed by the New York Times were often on drugs or in psychological distress, and some had severe medical conditions. But in death after death, the New York Times found actions by police officers and law enforcement fell well outside the controlled conditions in the research the experts cited to exonerate them in the courts of law. Occasionally, the experts use identical language in different cases to rebut allegations and suggest alternative explanations for the deaths. They also emphasize common ailments like heart disease or leaned heavily on the poorly understood notion of excited delirium.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
You're listening to Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on Islamic revolution. Thanks to Islamic revolution, political dependence has been completely uprooted in our country. October 18th, 2017.
Political dependence came to an end thanks to the revolution. We were thankfully liberated, but that we are still dependent in terms of the economy and culture. We should work on this because dependence will lead to disaster. I will tell you that when I look at the memoirs which have been written by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's friends, I read that in certain cases, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi himself was extremely angry at the Americans. He sometimes cursed them. Of course, he did so in his private room and in the company of his close friends. He was like a person who goes to his rooftop and swears at a policeman in a distant city. He used to swear at them in his private room, but whenever the British and the US ambassador delivered a message, made a phone call, and issued a command, he was ready to bow to them and obey their command. He had no choice, and he had to do so. This is dependence. This should be destroyed. Well, political dependence has been completely uprooted in our country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. The Islamic Revolution moved the people from the periphery into the center. August 3rd, 2017.
From the beginning of the revolution, the people of Iran have played their role 12 times in electing the highest-ranking officials of the country. Moreover, the people's choices and votes have brought about 10 Islamic consultative majlises, 5 city and village councils, and 5 assemblies of experts. All these have been achieved thanks to the revolution. Our new generation should not forget certain things. We experienced the pre-revolutionary era with all our being. Before the victory of the revolution, the people did not have any role in the management of the country and in the appointment of the managers. Heads of countries, monarchs, kings, and their cohorts used to come and go, but the people were mere spectators. They did not have any role. The Islamic Revolution came and moved the people from the periphery into the center. This way, the people were given the power to choose everything.
Great powers of the world confess they can't resist the influence of Iran in West of Asia. June 7th, 2017.
The policies of the great powers in the world have become trapped in the mud in West Asia. These policies have failed. They themselves say that this failure is because of the influence and power of the Islamic Republic. This is very important. They wanted to impose every disaster that they liked on Iraq and Syria, but they failed. Well, this is very important. This is the same thing that you wanted. This is the very same thing that the revolution wanted. The goals of the revolution have been attained, but the goals of the US and its allies, not only the US, have not. This is only an example of such victories, capabilities, and achievements.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Gave me hope, oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I wanna thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
It was the year UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson pledged to build back better. Some critics argued this was not just about restoring the UK's fiscal position after the ravages of COVID on the economy, but on reviving the country's international reputation that had taken a global hit after a few glaring missteps. If Johnson was hoping for a glorious scorecard to see out his political year, he was going to be left disappointed. Not only had he failed to make vital political inroads on the international stage, some pointed to the UK having gone backwards in some respects.
Britain no longer has this huge empire that it once had. It doesn't have a presence in any serious sense east of Suez. It was badly defeated in Afghanistan over the summer. That's 20 years of war, which has shown that we've come completely full circle as a result of that war. And therefore there's Britain is being kind of cut down to size, I think, in terms of, you know, when people look at it. Its actual role in the world is much less.
For those expecting something different when it came to the sometimes subservient relationship that exists between Washington and London, well, 2021 was yet another year of disappointment, with the US setting the political agenda and Britain following that well-trodden path. The White House meeting between the US President Joe Biden and Britain's bumbling PM underscored the power imbalance between the two nations. After the trade deals dangled by the Trump administration failed to materialize, Johnson returned from Washington with nothing like the $300 billion in agreements, not that you'd sense the crushing disappointment at the time.
And then, of course, there's the progress that we're making in the defense technology partnership that you've led and with our Australian friends, that I think has great potential to benefit the whole of the world and the security of the whole of the world. So, Joe, thank you for having us, and I think, you know, we're boosting our shared agenda. We want to build back the world together with you. And I think we want to renew and strengthen our transatlantic bond. And it feels to me like it's going very, very well.
The shambolic withdrawal and embarrassing military climb down experienced by Britain's military after the US announced it was leaving Afghanistan exposed the UK's strategic weaknesses and had the minister in charge at the time attempting to explain the chaos away.
Of course didn't put...
So that's a lie.
We did not put the welfare of animals above individuals. I'm not accusing anyone of lying, I'm just correcting the facts. What is certainly true is that we had a lot of people rushing to get out of Afghanistan for all sorts of reasons, and I think it's right that we had a process in place.
Not only was the UK caught on the back foot having to follow the US on the Afghanistan issue, its foreign policy position continues to ape Washington's agenda on China, Russia, Iran, Yemen, and Palestine, to name but a few. Perhaps the only area of foreign policy divergence is Brexit, where Washington has reiterated its pro-Brussels sentiments. Britain's most complicated and increasingly acrimonious foreign policy situation is the one that London and Brussels now find themselves in. Having exited the European Union, Britain now finds itself at odds with its former ally, a situation that has not been this bad in decades. Lord Frost passing the job of securing Britain's post-Brexit policies onto Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, it will be an uphill task for 2022.
The trade deals that Britain has made since Brexit have amounted to very little, including there hasn't been one with the United States. And therefore, Britain is sort of desperately trying to cling on to this military role, while at the same time the wider economic issues are not necessarily going in their favour.
Britain's continued political pivot towards the US remains a risky strategy that has yet to bear genuine fruits for the UK in its own aims. With the country's Prime Minister still in bombastic, flag-waving mood, perhaps Boris Johnson feels tethering the UK's fortunes so closely to that of the US is still the way to go, despite new global realities indicating otherwise. Amina Taylor, London.
Thank you.
A meeting was held here in Western Kabul to bring the Islamic Emirate and the people closer together. The meeting was organized by a Shia association to pave the way for national solidarity in Afghanistan. During the meeting, the religious leaders and the Taliban officials stressed the need for mutual trust between people and the government.
One of the main responsibilities of the ruling group is nation building. Afghan nation is mainly composed of our Shia and Sunni brothers. We are part of United Ummah of Islam. In order to have a united Afghanistan, we should trust each other and rely on mutual values. The new government needs to represent all sections and ethnicities of Afghanistan.